Good afternoon. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM. And we're streaming live, of course, at freakradio.org. That's freakradio.org. Go to the main page and follow the instructions to catch our streaming link. Don't forget to turn your speakers up. My name is Ren Tawil, and this is the Mideast Migraine Show for December 8th, 2014. I walk into the studio and it is precisely 3 o'clock. The scheduled start time for this program, and considering that I try really, really hard never to be in here later than an hour before the show starts, I've had some very important local, as in studio-related business to attend to. And I just finished a conference with a resident of the premises. Now, that is out of the way. And given the fact that I had the meeting, I've had no preparation time at all. But fear not, I most definitely have something lined up. Several things are always lined up. What I mean by show preparation has to do with hopefully making all the reading material visible to my eyes. In other words, increasing the font size and making sure I have all the reading material in their proper context and proper folder. And so, okay, that's internal stuff here. Let's just get right down to it. I, Ren Tawil, am your friendly neighborhood Palestinian American who, without question, is presenting what some would say is a biased presentation of the Middle East conflict, biased in favor of the Palestinians and to the Arabs to some degree. It's not a question of being proud of any kind of bias. It comes from the position that the local and generally the American bias on this issue is already and has for many, many, many years been strongly and far overly on the side of Israel. And it's slowly coming out that this is the case and people are more willing to admit that, hey, maybe there's more going on here that we should take a closer look at. I am not talking about a massive switch of sides from the Israeli narrative to the Palestinian narrative. It's really not a question of arguing entirely in someone's favor and turning on someone that you may have felt has been a good, loyal friend of yours for a long time. But we do need to get realistic about this. And in my mind, that requires that the Palestinian narrative, their take on this whole thing and what has really been going on with them and with Israel, needs a lot more exposure. That's why I'm here. That's what this show is about. I already have, well, I'll call them what they are, enemies. At least in their minds, they are enemies of what I do and what this program is about. I'm despised for it. And again, this is because these people go into this automatic mode of, my God, he supports terrorists. Maybe he is a terrorist. He must be a Muslim. You know, this is just more Arab propaganda, and once again, Israel's being victimized by it. Well, in the course of the show, I hope people will begin to see that there's more to it than that. Incidentally, no, I'm not a Muslim. I am not of the Islamic faith. I was born and raised in California here, and I grew up in the Lutheran Church because my father and his family, all from Jerusalem, none of them considering themselves to be Israelis, but Palestinians. In Jerusalem, my dad's family were Christian. They were Lutheran. That may be a surprise to many people to hear. Of course, most people do understand that there have always been Christians in the Holy Land anyway, which is to say, ethnic Arabs, who almost always spoke Arabic as their first language. There are Christian Arabs and there are Muslim Arabs, and of course, for a few thousand years, there have always been Jews, residing continuously in the Holy Land, so far as we can tell, not having... Oh, I was going to talk about DNA and chromosomes, but let's not even get into that. I take it for granted there had never been Jews for a long time, and Arabs for a long time, and Christians, likewise, for a very long time. So, many of you know that there have been and are a shrinking number, frankly, of Christians in Palestine and in Israel, in the Israel's occupied territory of Palestine, and that, but beyond there merely being Christians, I don't think too many Americans are used to thinking in terms of specific Protestant denominations, Lutherans, Presbyterians, Baptists, or whatever, but they're all there. That's the thing about the centrality of the Holy Land, and of Jerusalem in particular, focusing on the Old City. That there are basically representations of just about every religion in the world to some degree or another, because that's the nature of the real estate. That's one aspect of the real estate of Jerusalem and its environs, is it is holy to so many people. Okay, now, we've got... I'm just... seeing what I have for you today. Oh, the phone number. I suppose I should give that out. Especially given the fact that it is now 1510 hours, also known as 3:10, now 3:11 p.m. in the afternoon, Pacific time zone, 3:11 p.m. on this Monday, December 8th, 2014. If that jives with your own time-space continuum, then you know that that you're listening to a live program, not a rerun or an archived version. 3:11 p.m. on December 8th. So you may call in to the studio at any time. The area code is 831-427-3772. Again, area 831-427-3772. 427-3772. Let's start with something that I haven't read yet, so I don't know if they have anything to say about the Middle East. I kind of suspect not, but, you know, I do think it's important to provide balance of the appeal of this program and not just talk about Arabs and Jews all the time. This from Daily Kos. Meet the Press explains why Congress is broken. Quote, all you need to know, half of them are millionaires. And, okay. And I just picked this up today, I think, from Daily Kos. Meet the Press explains why Congress is broken. All you need to know, half of them are millionaires, is the quote. Those who saw Meet the Press today, which is to say yesterday, Sunday, were treated to a rare act of journalism. They actually have a transcript from the Meet the Press show December 7. I'm not going to be reading from the transcript, or maybe portions of it. I'll be reading from very small portions of the words that transpired on the TV program Meet the Press. Chuck Todd said, nerd screen time about Congress and wealth. The majority of Americans, of course, think members of Congress are out of touch with average citizens. 81%, according to Gallup's most recent survey, of Americans think that Congress is out of touch with average citizens. In fact, average Americans don't think members of Congress understand their needs or concerns. And this is TV journalist and host Tuck Chodd speaking here. And that members of Congress are too beholden to special interests. Well, there's a big reason why our representatives here in Washington appear to have a hard time relating to most of you. And it starts with a massive wealth gap. Let's take a look at the numbers. First of all, members of Congress make a lot more money than the average American. Typical household income, $54,000 annual. That's for the common people, $54,000. The annual salary for each member of Congress, it's nearly $175,000, three times as much. And, oh, by the way, that's not household income. This doesn't include spousal income. You included that, it's even much higher. Not surprisingly, members of Congress are also doing better than average Americans when it comes to seeing their wealth grow. On average, median net worth for average Americans grew just under 4% annually from 2004 to 2012. In that same period of time, members of Congress saw their income increase at a 15% clip annually. The result? By 2013, the average 55 to 65 year old, that's about the average age of a member of Congress, had a net worth of just over $165,000. That is the net worth. And that includes real estate holdings. The average net worth for a member of Congress? Just over $1 million of real estate. And that does not include real estate holdings. They don't have to report on that on their forms. I take it to mean he means internal revenue forms. The tax people. If they did, that number would be even higher. Members of Congress, over half of them, remember there are 535 of them, House members and senators, over half of them are millionaires. So you wonder why the economy, income equity, all of these issues, you don't feel like Congress quite understands the urgency of it. This is all you need to know. Half of them are millionaires. Now here's another short essay here by Sean McKelvey. As Congress gets richer and richer, research proves that it's leaving the rest of us behind. Congress is rich. The average net worth in Congress is a bit more than $6 million, while the median net worth is $1 million. I'm going to say that again. The average net worth in Congress is a bit more than $6 million on average. Per Congress member. The median net worth is $1 million. To put that in context, $4 million in net worth is enough to put someone in the top 1%, and $660,000 is enough to put an individual in the top 10%. Meanwhile, the median family wealth for whites is $134,000, and for blacks is $11,000. Emerging political science research suggests that the implications of this class bias are profound and important. Political scientists have long debated the importance of, in quotes here, descriptive representation or reflective democracy. Reflective democracy means that representatives share salient characteristics with their constituents. Most political scientists now agree that reflective representation leads to better substantive representation, that the interests of constituents are being reflected by legislator choice. It's increasingly clear that descriptive representation matters, particularly as related to race and gender. While descriptive representation of women and people of color has increased dramatically, the descriptive representation of working class people has remained stubbornly flat. Let's see. Left Coaster. He's referring to someone named Carnes. I think I might have mentioned the name. Maybe not. At any rate, As someone says here, as Carnes writes, if millionaires were a political party, that party would make up roughly 3% of American families, but it would have a supermajority in the Senate, a majority in the House, a majority in the Supreme Court, and a man in the White House. So even most of our Supreme Court justices are millionaires. If working class Americans were a political party, that party would have made up more than half the country since the start of the 20th century, over 100 years ago. But legislators from that party, those who last worked in blue-collar jobs before entering politics, would never have held more than 2% of the seats in Congress. Not more than 2% of the seats in Congress. Michael Krause and Bennett Callaghan find that rich members of the House are more likely to accept high levels of inequality than less rich members. The effect is particularly strong on Democrats. A Mother Jones investigation, Mother Jones is a progressive publication magazine, the investigation finds that the 10 richest members of Congress, a bipartisan group, all voted to extend the Bush tax cuts, Democrats as well as Republicans. Given this, should we worry that more than half of all members of the House of Representatives are millionaires? Further, while two-thirds of the population don't have a college degree of the U.S. population, two-thirds do not have a college degree. Only two House members, Robert Brady of Pennsylvania and Stephen Fincher of Tennessee, and one senator, outgoing Mark Begich of Alaska, lack one. As Congress becomes more gender and racially diverse, it remains a preserve of the economic and education elites. As the Democratic Party increasingly moves to the center to please an elite donor base, the last hope for action on economic equality might be more blue-collar politicians. As class divisions and their resulting inequality become a critically important issue for tens of millions of American households, the economic elites grip on our Congress grows ever stronger. The Congress preoccupation with catering to the needs of millionaires, like lowering estate taxes, has made the Congress one of the most despised and distrusted institutions in America. Noblesse oblige, social status and economic inequality, maintenance among politicians. In the first half of the 19th century, that would be the 1800s, for any American politician to be seen as a member of the wealthy elite was the kiss of death. To be born in a log cabin was seen as the ideal background for those with political ambitions. Americans had a healthy distrust of wealthy elites. That was in the 19th century. We need some of that healthy distrust of wealth elites back. Okay, so says Chuck Todd. Or maybe that was a continuation of the Sean Elway's piece here. It's these things that I get from Daily Kos. That's Daily KOS. I think Kos is somebody's name. It's a little confusing, the format of the way that they lie this shit out. But, all right, folks, that's what that was. Put that away. Needed to say something about the current situation in America. All right, let's roll along here. Oh, I also want to get an idea of who all's listening online. Isn't that exciting? You get a very vague, imaginary idea of what I'm doing here. Okay, well, the important thing is, folks, we have our antenna back up. Yes, we are broadcasting at 101.3 on the FM dial, 101.3. I need to remind this every time I do a show now. Given the intermittency, the up and down quality of our transmitter over the past 18 or so months, for a small variety of reasons, we have gone through some very extended periods of not being on the radio dial. If you try to tune into 101.3 FM to hear Free Radio Santa Cruz and you don't hear anything, or you hear somebody else, do not assume that there is no more Free Radio Santa Cruz. We are alive and well. We're working on our problems here, given our consistent problem of not having very much money at all to work with, and the other logistical problems that we need to put up with. We have a number of things to work on. But again, if you do not hear us on the air, on the traditional radio waves air at 101.3 FM, never fear. Simply, most of you, I'm sure, will be able to go to some internet connection somewhere. I understand the public library is not very practical for listening to stuff, although I think they do have headphones. But for those of you, I tend to presume a great majority, who do have internet access, who listen to Free Radio, pick us up on our streaming link. Go to www.freakradio.org. That's Freak Radio, F-R-E-A-K, freakradio.org, freakradio.org. And we will explain to you how to pick up our streaming link. So, one way or another, either on our stream or online, you've got Free Radio Santa Cruz. We are, by the way, looking forward to our 20th anniversary of liberating the airwaves, when we can. As an underground pirate radio service, truly grassroots, community-oriented, that's why we're here. And that is the motivation behind those of us who produce these programs for you or provide radio programs from other sources. We do a lot of those too. So, we're here for you. We endeavor to remain with you. At the moment, we are. At the moment, we are on both the stream and we are broadcasting. That's incorrect. I just checked it myself. That's why I'm talking about it as though I just found out. We're streaming and we're broadcasting. Okay, back to biz. This is pretty fascinating. I picked this up just a couple of days ago. Good old BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement against Israeli academic and cultural life, and to some degree, their economic life. BDS, this is from the Palestinian BDS National Committee. Tell the United Nations not to reward Israel for their Gaza massacre. Wrap your little brains around that. They want us, this is one of those action newsletters, tell the United Nations not to reward Israel for the Gaza massacre. Here's what's going on. International donors have pledged $5.4 billion to rebuild Gaza after Israel's 50-day assault last summer that killed 2,254 Palestinians, including 538 children, and caused widespread destruction. But studies show that at least 45% of the aid pledged by international groups will go to the Israeli economy. The companies that are set to rake in profits providing materials for the reconstruction of Gaza are corporate criminals. Companies like Nesher and ReadyMix pillage Palestinian natural resources and participate in the construction of illegal settlements, illegal Jewish-only settlements, who consider themselves to be an extension of the State of Israel. That's not proper. That's against international law. It is time the UN feel the extent of public outcry as details emerge on the UN's complicity in keeping Gaza under siege and the ways in which Israeli companies will profit from the reconstruction of Gaza. Take action now and send a message to key UN officials urging them to stop Israel from profiting from Gaza's destruction and to adopt a procurement policy that exclude corporate criminals from tenders for Gaza reconstruction. Thanks. The Palestinian BDS National Committee, you can hook up to the link there for the petition that they're making us all aware of. If you go to the Palestinian BDS National Committee, Google it or type it in there. Palestinian BDS National Committee. Just maybe it would be sufficient to just type in Palestinian BDS. Here is the specific link. I'll just spell it out for you. http://www.bdsmovement.net/don't-reward-Israel. That's the internet link, or just go to bdsmovement.net and you too will be able to sign the petition. Pretty remarkable. First, the Gazan people suffer a hellish assault on them. The third over 6 years now, a good 6 years, starting in 2008. Thousands were killed then. Thousands were killed in November of 2012, just over 2 years ago. And both of those two wars, by the way, were clearly politically motivated. They both took place only a few weeks before Israel's national elections, which is to say the message from the leadership behind the military assaulters is saying, let's go kill a bunch of Arabs so we can get reelected into office. Pretty much the same kind of thinking as Bush the Elder, Bush 41, when he decided to go into, or to browbeat Congress into letting him go into, to select Kuwait as the target of a war, ostensibly to oust Saddam Hussein's people. On the surface, it all sounded proper, a good reason to go to war with somebody, but is by no means the only instance in the modern world where one country goes into another. After all, Israel has been going into territory which was not designated to them by the British imperialists up until 1948. There was no state of Palestine, but that today that's only because Israel refuses to allow a sovereign state of Palestine to come into existence. And, of course, Israel attacked the Golan Heights in Syria in 1967. And in that same year, as they did in 1956, Israel attacked and succeeded in conquering the entirety of Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, right up to the eastern edge of the Suez Canal. U.S. President Eisenhower forced Israel to give it back in 1956, but they retook it 11 years later and hung on to it until the early 1980s. Okay, so please go to Palestinian BDS National Committee. And as I was saying, after all that carnage, we have terrible, you know, these $5.4 billion pledged by donors around the world to rebuild the Gaza Strip again after Israel unnecessarily clobbered it, supposedly a defensive action. And Israel is benefiting economically from that. You know, it keeps their people at work while they continue to wreck the Gazan economy. The economic siege of the Gaza Strip is still being continued over the Gazans. They hate the Hamas government. And in spite of all the terrible genocidal intentions that we hear about Hamas harboring towards the Jews, what no one seems to remember in this country or even be aware of is that the Hamas has, in most instances, agreed to maintain ceasefires, agreed to with Israel, sometimes for a few months at a time, which is to say there will be no missiles or mortars flying out of the Gaza Strip into Israel. Hamas usually keeps their end of the bargain until it's broken by Israel. We just don't hear about that, if at all. Okay. Ray of hope. I'm pretty sure I did. Yes, I did read that to you. I do need, as I tried to make excuses for at the beginning of this program, intervening circumstances prevented me from cleaning out my preparation folder, so I have to go through the things that I've already spoken with you about one by one. This is the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Rand Tuwiel, so you know what and who to blame for this terrible quality of programming. Kitchen controversy, that was really something. You know, if you want to find out more about these other articles that I mentioned in passing, you can go to this program's archives. Two separate websites. One is radioforall.net, that's R-A-D-I-O, the number four, all.net, radioforall.net. Type in Mideast Migraines into the search engine, and you will see my programs, the recordings of previous programs. Almost all of my previous programs that I managed to record successfully, roughly in chronological order, the most recent first, under Mideast Migraines. You might also try Mideast Madness, this program's original name, previous name, for the older programs that would give you access to. And you can catch up on the stuff of most current importance. Hurry up and go to radioforall.net so it doesn't get too old. As they say in the newspaper business, there's nothing more stale than yesterday's news. But not when it comes to the stuff that I talk to you about. The other website containing the archives for my recorded programs is Santa Cruz Indie Media, Indie Bay. That's a very peculiar collection of words, I know. This is the Indie Bay server site that also serves San Francisco and perhaps other locations for community-oriented audio and video and print news. Santa Cruz Indie Bay. And click on Palestine and find my programs there. The most recent programs that I've uploaded to Santa Cruz Indie Bay, you will find in the right-hand length of the page, right-hand marginal box, this green box, scroll down. My most recent stuff is towards the bottom in the last category. Okay. Rick Steves, I spoke with you a few weeks ago about him. Now, here's one. This may be a repeat, but I think it's of critical importance. This is an ongoing and fairly recent problem that those who seek the truth in America about Israel and Palestine, a problem that we have to put up with. This from the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, November 17. They want us to protest attempts to monitor and to defund Middle East studies on campus. American Jews, propagated largely by Israel and Israel's U.S. lobby in Washington, want their followers, their loyalists, to they've been targeting Middle East studies departments on university and college campuses across North America, the United States as well as Canada, because what's apparently, there's a lot of truth to the fact that there is a more balanced presentation of what's going on in Israel and Palestine in these Middle East studies departments in higher education institutions, more balanced than ever, because they're beginning to pay more attention to the Palestinian narrative, to the other side, instead of constantly getting this feed from Israel and from AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, Israel's lobby here in the U.S. They're upset that the pendulum is starting to swing in the other way, not, again, as I was saying earlier, not to completely disfavor everything that Israel has to say, but merely to mention that there are positive aspects and constructive things to say coming from the Palestinians and their side of the story. This U.S. campaign is another attempt to get your signature to a petition. They want you to protest attempts to monitor and to defund, take the monies away from Middle East studies on campuses. This is a terrible specter, a terrible threat to remove the money from anyone who tends, for any reason, to side to any degree with the Palestinians about things economically, or whether you're talking about education or whatever. Let's take their money away. Let's hit them in the pocketbook. In other words, this is Israel's attempt to their way of fighting back against the BDS movement, to likewise try to cripple various aspects of Israeli life and Israeli society by depriving them of money, by putting a dent in their economy. This, of course, is done because we have tried everything else. The Palestinians have tried everything else. Israel always makes it look like it's the Palestinians' fault or the other Arab countries' fault that there's no peace between Israel and everyone else there. But the fact is that Israel has an insidious, not well covered in the news way of wrecking, sabotaging these efforts to make peace with the Palestinians. Okay, what does this one say here? 10 years ago, Campus Watch, a pro-Israel organization attempting to blacklist professors sympathetic to Palestinian rights, published legislation to install a government-appointed advisory board to weed out criticism of Israel in campus Middle East studies programs receiving federal government funds. It's like I said, the pro-Israel camp is blacklisting professors who have any leanings towards the Palestinian story, and the Campus Watch, the pro-Israel group, pushed legislation in our Congress, pushed it through to install a government-appointed advisory board to weed out criticism of Israel by denying them federal education funds. Back then, we formed a coalition of 100 groups and successfully beat back this McCarthyite effort. But similar groups, such as the Brandeis Center and the AMCHA Initiative, are at it again, this time pressing the Department of Education to monitor the content of these educational programs and to defund those that don't have diverse perspectives, what they put in quotes here as diverse perspectives. In other words, returning to the old line, this would be lean heavily in favor of the Israeli narrative. Says here, through sketchy methodology, bogus congressional quotes and an erroneous conflation of legitimate criticism of Israel's policies with anti-Semitism. Let me read that again so you understand what I'm saying here about anti-Semitism. Through sketchy methodology, bogus congressional quotes, they're lying to us right there, and an erroneous conflation of legitimate criticism of Israel's policies with anti-Semitism, they're trying to make like anyone who has anything bad to say about Israel must hate Jews. These groups falsely claim that Middle East studies programs receiving government funding are laced with anti-Israel bias and even anti-Semitism, and should therefore be defunded for lacking, quote, diverse perspectives. It's urgent that we mobilize again to defeat this latest attempt of the pro-Israel thought police to shred academic freedom and banish any and all criticism of Israel from campus. It's happening again, folks. It's rearing its ugly head over the horizon, taking actions, and U.S. campaign to end the occupation wants us to deal with it. So, again, here you can go to the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, or just Google U.S. campaign and take it from there. You should be able to find it easily enough. Click on that link and sign their petition. They want us to take a minute to write Education Secretary Ann Duncan and our members of Congress to state our support for academic freedom and federally funded Middle East studies programs and your opposition to the government monitoring and passing judgment on the content of university education. That's pretty scary, folks. After all, this is supposed to be America. If you go to that site and find that petition, it is a petition. They say they want us to write Secretary and Education Secretary Arne Duncan and members of Congress, but they already have, I'm pretty sure they already have a petition set up to make it easy for you to do that. So give that a thought too. There's more here on this effort. We'd Laugh Off the Brandeis Center and AMCHA initiative reports, which are debunked in this excellent FAQ published by member group Middle East Research and Information Project, if it weren't for the fact that members of Congress are using them to advance the effort to stifle criticism of Israel on campus. They would laugh if it weren't for that fact. In fact, Representative Nita Lowey, Democrat from New York, an ardent supporter of Israel, parroted the false claims in these reports, insisting to Duncan that Middle East studies programs are, and I quote, disproportionately focused on and are biased against Israel, could, quote, endanger anti-Semitism. I'm sorry, I said that wrong. And they could, quote, engender anti-Semitism, end quote, and should be defunded. Could be. Members of Congress such as Lowey may even attempt to write this, quote, thought policing into law by amending Title VI of the Higher Education Act, which funds language and area studies at universities when it comes up for reauthorization soon. That's why we urgently need you to help head off this effort before it gathers any more momentum. Go to the petition. Let's be real. The last thing these pro-Israel groups want is diverse perspectives on campus. What they want to do is quash all academic criticism of Israel, as evidenced by recent witch hunts against Professor Rabab Abdulhadi and Professor Stephen Salaita. What they aim to accomplish is to stamp out all student activism in support of Palestinian rights, as evidenced by unwarranted repression against Students for Justice in Palestine chapters on campuses such as Florida Atlantic University, Northeastern University, and Loyola University, and many others. Make no mistake about it. These efforts by pro-Israel groups to stifle voices and smother campus activism are tactics of desperation, persuasive evidence that even these groups admit that Israel can no longer be defended. But of course, these groups still enjoy much clout, which is why we need you today to help us push back on this effort to monitor and defund Middle East studies programs. Thanks for taking this action to support academic freedom. Sincerely, Josh Rubner, the policy director of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. P.S. University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, one of the universities targeted by these reports, the false reports, responds that they are based on, and I quote, incomplete statistical evidence, take snippets of talks given by invited speakers and present them out of context, and use ad hominem attacks against respected scholars that verge on the libelous, end quote. So halfway through this, my memory slapped me on the side of the head here and said, hey, yes, I did read this on a previous show a week or two ago. I certainly don't mind going through it again. I want to take a closer look at this, these frequently asked questions regarding the Brandeis Center and AMSHA initiative reports. So let's see if we can go into that. Here it is, from the Middle East Research and Information Project. I'm enjoying a little bit of candy here, with the things I had to deal with immediately before today's program. I wasn't even able to buy myself a refreshing beverage to enjoy while I'm doing the program. So why is he eating candy? It doesn't make a lot of sense. A little post-Thanksgiving holiday treat, as far as I'm concerned. Okay. MIRIP, the Middle East Research and Information Project. Discussion, a discussion of Title IV in Middle East Studies, what you should know. Title IV refers to U.S. congressional legislation, which has to do with federal funding for institutions of higher learning, colleges and such. It's Title VI, excuse me. I think I might have said Title IV. Title VI and Middle East Studies, What You Should Know by Becca Wolf, published November 14 of this year. In the past few years, pro-Israel groups have mounted an escalating and concentrated effort to set the contours of scholarly debate about Israel on American campuses. This fall, two such organizations, the AMCHA Initiative and the Louis D. Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law, are lobbying Congress and the Department of Education to punish Middle East study centers that present alternatives to staunchly pro-Israel viewpoints. So, in other words, they're saying there is already a very, very Israel-centric or Israelocentric viewpoint that gets most or all of the attention by the faculty and teaching staffs of universities and colleges. I'll continue here. The lobbying campaign demands that the Education Department stop federal funding to these centers under Title VI of the Higher Education Act, or engage in intrusive oversight of the departments to assure the prevalence of viewpoints more sympathetic to Israeli government policies. The Higher Education Act is up for congressional reauthorization this year. What is Title VI? Here we get into the questions and answers here. What is Title VI? Title VI of the Higher Education Act, or HEA, provides federal funding to support teaching of foreign languages and area studies at United States universities. The law has been on the books since the Cold War. Its purpose is to facilitate the training of experts in fields of study deemed relevant to U.S. foreign policy. Russian language centers are some of the first programs funded under the HEA. Today, Title VI funds many Middle East studies programs in addition to international studies and language programs for every region of the world. Question: what are the claims made about Middle East studies centers with Title VI funding? The claims made about Middle East studies centers with this federal funding. The Brandeis Center, along with a coalition of smaller groups, has launched a campaign to police scholarly work and teaching in Middle East studies departments across the country. To police scholarly work. in Middle East Studies departments that the principal tactic of this campaign is to equate any criticism of the state of Israel with anti-Semitism or the hatred of Jews or of the Jewish religion, to equate those criticisms with anti-Semitism and thereby declare that entire Middle East programs are intrinsically biased against Israel. Their end goal is to influence the political outlook of academic work on U.S. campuses, applauding work that takes an unquestionably positive view of Israeli state policy and censoring or sanctioning work that is critical of the facts of that work that is critical of the acts or policies of Israel. That attempt to impose orthodoxy is a project antithetical to the mission of the academic institution, which should be committed to wide-ranging research and analysis, unbounded by the political agendas that often dictate government decisions. As part of this political campaign, the Brandeis Center recently issued a quote-unquote white paper advancing three main arguments. This is from the Brandeis Center. Point one, Middle East studies programs at several universities are filled with anti-Semitic and anti-Israel bias. Their words. Point two, Title VI of the Higher Education Act requires funding recipients to provide a, quote, balanced view, at least of Israel. In quotations, balance essentially means inserting more sympathetic views of Israel. And point three, Congress has previously concluded that Middle East studies programs are, quote, biased against Israel and thus should implement a grievance and investigation procedure for the reporting of such bias. This is frightening stuff, folks. Having our institutions, independent institutions of higher learning that happen to use federal funding, cave to the political interest of those who have the money and the political power to fight a truly balanced view of what's going on. Don't forget, you can call this show, folks. You can call me here at the studio, area code 831-427-3772. That's area 831 here in Santa Cruz County on the left coast of California, area code 831-427-3772. The line is open. And the ringers are on. I'm very closely monitoring my own ability to push buttons and make things work here, technically speaking. Okay. They want academics perceived to be sympathetic to Israel in order to... Where exactly did I... I think this is where I left off. What does this campaign demand? The AMCHA Initiative. Brandeis Center and allied groups demand either that Congress cancel all Title VI funding, all federal Title VI funding of Middle East studies programs, or that it mandate that the Department of Education establish a mechanism to receive complaints of, quote, bias, and then investigate academic centers in order to coerce those centers to promote pro-Israel viewpoints. Now, obviously, this is the wording of this group here, the Middle East Research and Information Project. This is their interpretation of what's going on. Earlier, I mentioned the white paper that some of these groups have advanced. And the three points that I read is Mirip's interpretation of it, just so we know here. We're not necessarily reading directly from the white paper, etc. Okay. In place of bias and then investigate academic centers in order to coerce those centers to promote pro-Israel viewpoints. They suggest the formation of a committee to oversee all Middle East studies programs and search for, quote, bias. This committee, they suggest, should include, and I quote, academics from Israel studies programs, end quote. They want academics perceived to be sympathetic to Israel to oversee the programming in Middle East studies. Where does the bias lie now, if that ever came to be? Question. Is there evidence of bias in Middle East studies programs? Getting to the meat of it now. The Brandeis Center relies heavily on a quote-unquote study published by AMCHA about UCLA's Center for Near East Studies, the CNES. The study contends that 93% of CNES programs related to Israel are biased, and that the programming has a quote-unquote disproportionate focus on Israel. This study is plagued with problems, the Brandeis study, not least of which are overly broad and unreasonable definitions of anti-Israel bias and of anti-Semitism. Anything straying from narrow pro-Israel orthodoxy is automatically judged to be biased, as is the case of the following events. Point. A film about diverse perspectives on Israel within the Jewish community, in which the Jewish filmmakers interviewed people from groups as different as Stand With Us and Jewish Voice for Peace. And the other point is an event on a variety of Jewish perspectives about Israel-Palestine, including binationalism, that was co-sponsored by the Jewish Studies Program. Thus, AMCHA's initiative of bias is so expansive that it includes events sponsored by J Street, the pro-Israel, pro-peace group, and the Jewish Studies Program at UCLA. In other words, even when Jews, those interviewed or those doing the interviewing, and those professors and instructors who pass this information along are targeted as well, if they have what can in any way be interpreted as criticism of Israel, or even anti-Semitism. Even Jews are being targeted. AMCHA's study also fails to place its analysis in the context of CNES programming about countries other than Israel-Palestine. It is typical for scholars to criticize aspects of the nation-states they study. Does UCLA CNES shy away from exposing problems in the policies of other Middle Eastern governments? The answer is clearly no. If events like, quote, the persistence of the past, how violence and genocide in Ottoman Turkey affect our world today, another one here, stopping the nuclear threat from Iran, Egypt, stillborn revolution, and the constitution and legal status of non-Shiites in Iran are any indication? The answer is no if those events, films, study series, whatever, are any indication. AMCHA's claims of anti-Semitism in CNES events fare no better when subjected to scrutiny. For instance, AMCHA's example of anti-Semitic activity at CNES includes statements by speakers that Israel, and I quote, denies the absolute basic and inalienable human rights of Palestinians, that Israel, quote, was created through colonialism, and that, quote, colonialism and settler colonialism are both inherently and unequal and unjust systems, end quote. These statements are judgments about the history and politics of the Israeli state and government and express no animus toward Jewish people because of their religion or ethnicity. As an open letter from professors of Jewish studies concludes, AMCHA's definition of anti-Semitism is so broad as to render the term meaningless. These and other problems prompted the Middle East Studies Association's Committee on Academic Freedom North America to publish an open letter calling on AMCHA, and I quote, to withdraw its report and to apologize to all those whom it falsely intend, tendentiously accuses of anti-Semitism. CNES at UCLA has now issued its own detailed rebuttal of the accusations made by the AMCHA initiative and others. And just to keep us abreast of what's going on, if you've just tuned in, this is the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, non-compliant to Federal Communications Commission's corporately dictated icy iron grip. Free Radio Santa Cruz, looking forward to celebrating our 20th year next March. Celebration plans are in the works. We broadcast at 101.3 on the FM dial, and we are streaming right now online at freakradio.org. That is freakradio.org. Reading from this November 14 Middle East Research and Information Project. Title VI in Middle East Studies, What You Should Know. Okay. It's a long piece. And yes, it's pretty hairy, but it's worth indulging and giving me your attention, because there are some fascinating pieces in here about freedom, truly about academic freedom, which is a catchphrase you're hearing a lot these days, especially about Palestinians and Arabs and Israelis and Jews. Okay, next section here. A question. Does Title VI require balance? The Brandeis Center's report claims that when Congress amended the language of Title VI of the Higher Education Act in 2008 to refer to, quote, diverse perspectives in federally funded programs, it intended to require all programs to provide a, quote, balanced treatment of all subjects. While the Brandeis Center admits that the phrase diverse perspectives has never been defined, it suggests that the Department of Education can and should define it. In other words, a division of the U.S. government should set parameters for how much can be said about Israel and its policies and how critical they might be. I added that little explanation in there. Continuing with this Q&A from Mirup. The report's characterization of the HEA, however, is inaccurate. Lydia? Please forgive the interruption. Personal phone call. I know, I was supposed to have something set up like music, and I failed to do that. So let's crank that sucker up. Here, I'm just making sure that I have something pleasant for you to listen to when I can't talk. Oh, let's go ahead and take a musical break here. What do I have for your listening pleasure? What do I have here? How about a little of the old Stuart Davis? He's coming up, folks. You're listening to the Mideast Migraine Show with your fumbling, sinful, apparently quite inept dude here hosting the program.
Mm-hmm. Modern man just loves to think and invent until his brain gets sore. Searching, learning, adding, so our existence keeps demanding more. With each advancement we adopt, progress, well, it ought to be stopped.
Rent a Wheel here with the Mideast Migraines program on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM. Streaming live at freakradio.org. Where was I? Okay. My personal schedule is just squished all over the place here. I'm smished in here. During my absence for 3 minutes to play that song, I sprayed my throat with 2 kinds of throat sprays, took my pills that I neglected to take after the morning meal. I'm an old booger. I have to think in terms of pills and follow through on those items. Not to mention my twice-a-week walk, extended walk. Okay. This is the Mideast Migraines program, and I'm reading from the Middle East Research and Information Project, November 14 communique, Title 6 of the Federal Department of Education and Middle East Studies, What You Should Know About Title 6, written by Becca Wolf. Oh, and I was interrupted by a phone call. Life is so hard. Here, let's start again with this question. Does Title VI require, quote, balance, end quote? The Brandeis Center's report claims that when Congress amended the language of Title VI of the Higher Education Act in 2008 to refer to, quote, diverse perspectives in federally funded programs, when it did that, and it intended to require all programs to provide a, quote, balanced treatment of all subjects. While the Brandeis Center admits that the phrase diverse perspectives has never been defined, it suggests that the Department of Education can and should define it. The Brandeis The report's characterization of the HEA, House Education Act, or whatever that stands for, the report's characterization of the HEA, however, is inaccurate. In 2008, congressional Republicans tried but failed to include an evaluation of diverse perspectives, quote unquote, as a criterion for assessing applications of Title VI funding. Rather, existing law simply requires applicants to explain how they intend to provide diverse perspectives, not that diversity of perspectives is a condition of funding. The law is clear that Congress considered and rejected a diverse perspectives criterion as a condition of Title VI funding. See Selection of Certain Grant Recipients Selection Criteria, Section 20 U.S.C. 1127B. Congress correctly rejected the position now taken by the Brandeis Center report. Sorry, scary noise outside the studio. Where was I? Congress correctly rejected the position now taken by the Brandeis Center report because it would place the Department of Education in the impossible and constitutionally suspect position of policing Middle East Studies departments for diverse perspectives, whatever that is, an imprecise and subjective standard that, if applied, would pose a substantial threat to academic freedom. How does this campaign threaten academic freedom and dissent? Constitutional protections of free speech are critical to the missions of universities. In fact, in Shelton v. Tucker, 1960, the Supreme Court said that, and I quote, "The vigilant protection of constitutional freedoms is nowhere more vital than in the community of American schools." End quote. Consistently from Esperson v. Arkansas, 1968, to Montero v. Tempe Union School High School District, 1998, and in other instances, federal courts have prohibited government interference with the content of speech in educational institutions. In West Virginia State Board of Education versus Barnett, 1943, the Supreme Court clearly affirmed that there are no circumstances under which the government can legitimately determine what is, quote, orthodox, whether in politics or religious beliefs, quote. If there is any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion, end quote. Congress clearly understood this matter when, as part of the 2008 amendments to Title VI of the HEA, they included the following qualification. Nothing in the subchapter shall be construed to authorize the Secretary to mandate, direct, or control an institution of higher education's specific instructional content, curriculum, or program of instruction. C-20 USC, Rule of Construction. This section is explicitly referenced in the giant... this section is explicitly referenced in the grant application form for National Resource Centers and Foreign Language and Area Studies programs. Thus, both Congress and the Department of Education have specifically acknowledged that they do not have the authority or the intent to prescribe to institutions of higher education what they must teach. At the same time, universities are already obliged to eliminate discrimination against students on the basis of race, color, or national origin, among other identity characteristics. There are ample mechanisms on the federal, state, and local level that protects students from discrimination in higher education. Most prominently, the Office of Civil Rights in the Department of Education provides a comprehensive regulatory scheme to address discrimination, including anti-Semitism. In fact, the Brandeis Center and its partners, including the Zionist Organization of America and the AMCHA Initiative, among others, have used this process to file complaints against at least four universities, asserting that Palestine activism creates a, quote, hostile environment for Jewish students on campus. Four such cases were dismissed after burdensome and lengthy investigations determined the claims were unfounded and that the expression in question was protected under the Free Speech Amendment. The Brandeis Center now seeks to duplicate the existing avenues for redress of cases of anti-Semitism by imposing a diverse perspectives requirement and enforcement mechanism in the Title VI funding structure. Existing law is more than adequate to deal with real instances of anti-Semitism on campuses. The reforms urged in the Brandeis Center report will create new opportunities for non-governmental, politically motivated organizations to misuse federal power to censor speech at universities that is critical of Israeli state policy or sympathetic to the rights of Palestinians. In so doing, it would impose a political orthodoxy in a way that would threaten academic freedom and the vitally important role that academic inquiry plays in the exploration of complex notions of identity, belonging, dispossession, statehood, and citizenship in the Middle East. Question: is the Brandeis Center's white paper a reliable source? Finally, it is worth noting that the Brandeis Center's report is filled with inaccurate citations and misrepresentations of the congressional record. These are more than simple typographical errors. The Brandeis Center has claimed that a congressional hearing, along with the head of the subcommittee itself, have already concluded that Middle East studies programs are biased and have attempted to prove this claim by citing to the record. Referring to a hearing held by the Senate Education Subcommittee of the House Committee on Education and the Workforce in June 2003, the Brandeis Center writes this. Thus, the committee concluded, in italics concluded, that the, quote, Department of Education has no way of assessing whether the outreach programs conducted by Title VI-funded Middle East Studies centers give a fair, historically accurate, and balanced view of the subject presented and thus fulfill the statutory purpose of providing not only language instruction, but, quote, full understanding of areas, regions, and countries in which such language is commonly used, end quotations. This quote refers not to a committee conclusion, but to testimony provided by the American Jewish Congress, and is clear in the record. And then parenthetically, even the citation for the report on the June 2003 hearing, referring to such, and they give the number here, the HR rep number, is incorrect. The first three digits of any House of Representatives report should refer to the congressional session, which are numbered biannually. Congress has not been meeting for over 1,600 years. Close parentheses. The Brandeis Center report also cites a statement by Representative Pete Hoekstra, Republican from Michigan, on the need to, quote, update programs under Title VI to reflect our national security needs in the post-9/11 era, end quote, as being made at the same hearing in June 2003. But Representative Hoekstra was not present at the hearing. His statement actually comes from a debate on the House floor of H.R. 3077, which failed to pass the Senate. Congressional Record, October 21, 2003. This bill was the first concerted attempt by by precursors of AMCHA and the Brandeis Center to create a new mechanism for preventing anti-Israel bias in Middle East studies programs. Okay, let's close this out here. There's one more question in this FAQ from the Middle East Research and Information Product. What's the bottom line? The Brandeis Center, as well as AMCHA and other organizations, are seeking to stifle legitimate protected speech on college campuses and restrict the free speech and academic freedom rights of those with whom they disagree, in addition to pressuring universities to punish students and academics for their advocacy for Palestinian rights. They're relying on shoddy, quote-unquote, studies and a misinterpretation of the law to convince lawmakers and officials at the Department of Education that Middle East studies programs are in need of regulation and defunding because of their supposedly biased content. The truth is that these organizations have presented no credible evidence of bias, none, in these programs, and no legal basis for demanding that the government monitor and regulate the content or curriculum of an academic institution. In the distribution of funding, Congress and the Department of Education must abide by the strictures that the First Amendment places on the government's ability to dictate the content of academic speech, despite what some lobbyists might claim. Academic institutions and associations that wish to express concern about the proposals to monitor Middle East studies programs and dictate their content can contact the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, at these two phone numbers, 1-800-USA-LEARN, 1-800-USA-LEARN. The second number is National Code 1, Area Code 202-401-3000, or by email at arne.duncan, A-R-N-E. D-U-N-C-A-N, arne.duncan@ed.gov. And there we are with that one. More music for your listening pleasures. The one you heard and at the previous break was entitled Progress. This next one, I believe, is Stefan's Exhibition.
Well, we artistic types are so misunderstood. While everyone's a critic, they don't know when something's good. Just let us have our space and freedom to create. And when the work is finished, we'll tell you if it's great. My painter friend is Stefan. I'm screwing his wife Mia. Well, no, it doesn't bother him. In fact, it's his idea. You common people try to pass it off as sick behavior, but it's how he gets inspired. I'm doing him a favor.
Artists want to share their gift. It's often that they can't. Thank God that Stefan finally got that NEA grant.
Stefan's exhibition is a masterpiece to see. It's a series done in oil of his wife in bed. All throughout his home, we cluttered every room with empty tubes of paint and foam. He's done good work before, but this is closer to his heart. I'm glad that I can help out my friend Stefan with his art.
Now Stefan was a prodigy and growing up was odd. Like Mapplethorpe multiplied by Marquis de Sade. Discovered porno, he was instantly consumed, and he fell in love with Mia, and his heart began to bloom. Congress tried to pull his funding, as his approach is raw. Well, technically, in many states, it is against the law. You know the one of Mia with the gerbil in her hand? It's called a veterinarian, it goes for 30 grand.
from the cognitive pollution we've suffered through and lived among. Father, free us, intervene and lift the curse. Drench this tainted planet so our handicap can be reversed. Now below the bow we hear the panicked cries of dying men. Thrashing in the water, it's cutting off their oxygen. But we are spared and providence will clearly show. All the meek inherit is the doom of their genetic code. The finger pointing came from God, finding his creation flawed. He decreed the final solution. Off you go, take a plunge. All of you have been expunged in the service of evolution. Our flagship embarks to populate a world with perfect genes, where no one's new one, three standard deviations from the mean. Mother Nature's second chance. It won't be long before the dove returns the olive branch. As for the dead, they only got what they deserved. It's all too obvious that God is grading on a curve. In his new kingdom, there isn't any simple niche. We won't need janitors or creeping drones to dig a ditch. We chosen girl will sail ahead until we find the true potential in a cultivated human mind. An unencumbered tribe are we, devoid of mediocrity. Every blemish he mended. All of us rejoice in some, are plotting to become a little smarter than the Lord intended. A flagship embarks to populate a world with perfect genes, where no one's new work, three standard deviations from me.
My family goes to sleep and we go down. scratches and marks all over your body when I let my nasty temper go. You're not as pretty since I broke your foot when I threw you against the wall. I burned you with my matches, razor cuts and scratches, and you forget and forgive it all. Believe me when I say I'm gonna leave my wife and find a magic doctor that'll bring you to life. I pretend that you need
Neck. Pretty bizarre stuff there from Stuart Davis of Minnesota. My longtime fans will say, gee, that Wren sure likes and plays a lot of Stuart Davis. You're right. That last item you heard was Barbie, and this is from his fourth album, Nomen Est Numen, circa, well, sometime in the 1990s, early 1990s, actually. Barbie, and before that was Noah's True Ark. And, of course, we began that string with Stefan's Exhibition. Razmia Odeh, Palestinian-American, American citizen. Razmia Odeh was convicted of fraud in her INS application to become a U.S. citizen. We've gone over those details in previous shows, which you can hear at radioforall.net or Santa Cruz Indie Bay, Media Santa Cruz, two separate websites. This is dated November 12. Oakland activists locked down. U.S. federal court to hash mark free Razmia now. Isn't that handy how they slip in that information into the headline here? Activists locked down. U.S. federal court in support of tortured Chicago community leader. She was tortured in Israel decades ago. Oakland rallies against conviction of Palestinian organizer. Press contact Laura Kizwani, Hatem Abudei. Laura Kizwani in Oakland, Abudei in Detroit. That was talking about an event that took place on Wednesday, November 12th, when they locked him and they did a sit-in in front of the U.S. federal court building in Chicago, I believe. Or wherever. This item from Oakland, California. Activists with the Bay Area Razmia Defense Committee have chained themselves to doors of the federal courthouse in Oakland to protest the conviction and imprisonment of 67-year-old Palestinian community organizer Razmia Odeh. Supporters are also rallying in front of the federal building, condemning what they call a politically motivated trial targeting Odeh because of her role as an outspoken Palestinian leader and activist. Odeh was convicted on Monday, November 10, in a Detroit federal court of knowingly lying, is the charge, lying on her immigration application, even though she maintains that she did not understand the questions on the application. The main basis for Odeh's conviction was that she had allegedly falsely answered no to a question asking whether she had ever been arrested or imprisoned. The government claimed that Odeh failed to disclose that she had been convicted by the Israeli government of participating in a quote-unquote terrorism, of participating in terrorism, even though this conviction in a military court lacked due process and was the result of a forced confession made after she was repeatedly tortured and raped by Israeli military authorities. Quote, the only reason Razmiya was imprisoned in Israel was because she was tortured, sexually assaulted, threatened with death, and ultimately forced to confess to charges she didn't commit, says Hatem Abu Daye, spokesman for the Razmiya Defense Committee. He went on to say, now more than 40 years later, and after 9 years of living here with U.S. citizenship, she's being made to relive her trauma and is wrongly imprisoned once again, end quote. Although the judge in the case allowed the Israeli conviction of Odeh to be used as evidence against her, the torture and rape she suffered, which the judge admitted was credible, was not allowed as evidence, a move that brought widespread condemnation from supporters and human rights activists alike. The targeting of Razmiya is purely to criminalize Palestinians who are outspoken and critical of Israel's oppression and occupation of Palestine, says Lara Kizwani, executive director of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center. The case against Odeh was originally part of a larger federal investigation in Chicago and Minneapolis, where the government has to this day unsuccessfully tried to convict 23 anti-war and Palestinian activists on trumped-up terrorism charges. Hundreds were present in court to support Odeh over the course of her trial in Detroit, and many more across the country have held solidarity demonstrations demanding that she be freed. Activists in the Bay Area will continue to protest and vow to intensify their efforts until Odeh is released. That piece, written by Henry Knorr. Quotation here, if Marx were living today, he'd be rolling around in his grave. Quotation from Randy Newman from his song, The World Isn't Fair. If Marx were living today, he'd be rolling around in his grave. Well, that's pretty much a given, isn't it? Has been for a long time. Okay. Well, this is Ren Tawil. Ren, by the way, is short for Lawrence, my given name. And no, it's not because I'm an Arab American, not because my father is a native of Jerusalem, Palestine. It's because, according to my dear mother, even when she was a little girl, she swore that she would name her first son Larry. So on the birth certificate it says Lawrence, and indeed I went by Larry for the first 50-odd years of my life. It's now just simply Ren Tawil, your friendly neighborhood Palestinian American, offering my take on the situation over there. This is the Mideast Migraine Show for December 8th, 2014, the Monday edition, which comes to you every Monday at 3 p.m., the Saturday edition, which currently features brand spanking new book reading that I began 2 days ago. The Saturday edition comes to you every Saturday at 11 a.m., 11 o'clock a.m. Pacific time. I'm in the middle of chapter 2 of Freedom Sailors, the true story of the Free Gaza Movement's initiation of voyages from various ports in the Mediterranean Sea to the Gaza Strip, against the desires of the Israeli government, who are not supposed to be stopping, as they not in recent years have been stopping these voyages in international waters, because they don't want people to go in and out of the port. They don't want Gaza to act like a free nation, even though everyone knows damn well they're not a free nation in actuality. Anyway, Freedom Sailors, now being read, just on chapter 2 now, on the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines. And by the way, the email address for this program is MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's the old name of the show, Mideast Madness at G's in Gregory. M is in Mitchell. X as in Xerxes.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. If anyone happened to write to that email address, I apologize. I haven't looked at it in over a week, so be assured I will eventually get to your messages. Let's see here. Well, gee, it's actually 9 minutes before the end of the program. So, yeah. I'm looking at a bunch of jokes that I could tell. In fact, I made the decision to start my shows with a bunch of jokes just to lighten up things, but since we're almost over, it's kind of, oh, what the heck. I'll try to take up where I left off. These are all from stand-up comedian Stephen Wright, who I haven't seen or heard much of from anymore. Is he still alive? I'll try to continue where I left off from. Okay. Now, this is either where I left off from on the last show where I told some of these, or from the party the other weekend where I was just dishing these jokes out to people. If God dropped acid, would he see people? That's the first joke, or one-liner. These are really very clever. Giggly one-liners are kind of cerebral. I tried to hang myself with a bungee cord. I kept almost dying. My friend is a baby. I'm recording all the noises he makes so later I can ask him what he meant. It's a small world, but I wouldn't want to paint it. I guess he doesn't like to paint things. Can you buy an entire chess set in a pawn shop? Always try to be modest and be proud of it. Why are there interstate highways in Hawaii? You ever think about that? Two babies were born on the same day at the same hospital. They lay there and looked at each other. Their families came and took them away. 80 years later, by a bizarre coincidence, they lay in the same hospital on their deathbeds next to each other. One of them looked at the other and said, "So, what did you think?" The other day I went to a tourist information booth and asked, "Tell me about some of the people who were here last year." It took me a long time to understand that one. You know, the New Testament is pretty old. I think they should call them the Old Testament and the Most Recent Testament. It is like putting a dehumidifier and a humidifier in the same room and letting them fight it out. Whatever he's referring to. If you saw a heat wave, would you wave back? Why doesn't the fattest man in the world become a hockey goalie? Oh, man, I misread that the first time. I thought it said, why doesn't the fastest man in the world become a hockey goalie? Which still makes sense. But this is, why doesn't the fattest man in the world become a hockey goalie? I think there's probably some restrictions on weight and size in the league. Regulation is there. I used to work in a fire hydrant factory. I couldn't park anywhere near the place. There was a power outage at a department store yesterday. 20 people were trapped on the escalators. Last year I went fishing with Salvador Dali. He was using a dotted line. He caught every other fish. If you can't hear me, it's because I'm in parentheses. When I was a fetus, I used to sneak out at night when my mother was sleeping. I figured I should start stealing stuff while I still had no fingerprints. How do you get off a nonstop flight? 99% of lawyers give the rest a bad name. What would a chair look like if your knees bent the other way? I'm a peripheral visionary. Laughingstock, cattle with a sense of humor. I was in the supermarket the other day and I met a lady in the aisle where they kept the generic brands. Her name was Woman. Cross-country skiing is fine as long as you live in a small country. I bought some batteries, but they weren't included, so I had to buy them again. When I was crossing the border into Canada, they asked if I had any firearms with me. I said, well, what do you need? If the universe is everything and scientists say that the universe is expanding, what is it expanding into? I had amnesia once or twice. I saw a bank that said 24-hour banking, but I didn't have that much time. How did a fool and his money get together in the first place? I washed a sock. Then I put it in the dryer. When I took it out, it was gone. If Dracula can't see his reflection in a mirror, how come his hair is always so neatly combed? Do radioactive cats have 18 half-lives? If you were sending someone some styrofoam, what do you pack it in? Smoking cures weight problems eventually. I planted some bird seed. A bird came up. Now I don't know what to feed it. The early bird may get the worm, but it's the second mouse who gets the cheese. Like from a trap, you know. I was in a grocery store. I saw a sign that said pet supplies. So I did. Then I went outside and saw a sign that said compact cars. Pet supplies, compact cars. Compact cars. Women, can't live with them, can't shoot them. I don't know why I didn't delete that one. A clear conscience is usually the sign of a bad memory. I'm just going to tell jokes until the end of the show today. Freight ends here towards the end. Is it possible to be totally partial? So I got off the plane and I forgot to take off my seatbelt and I'm dragging the plane through the terminal. Their wings are knocking people over. You know how it is when you're walking up the stairs and you get to the top and you think there's one more step? I'm like that all the time. I once locked my keys out of my car. I had to break out of my car with a coat hanger. Is tired old cliche one? I Xeroxed a mirror. Now I have an extra Xerox machine. And finally, yesterday my eyeglass prescription ran out. One and two liners from stand-up comedian Stephen Wright. Well, folks, I guess that's it for today's program. Don't forget, it will shortly appear within the week or so on my archives at radioforall.net, radio and the number four, radioforall.net, and Santa Cruz Indie Bay. Archives of these recorded programs. I will talk to you again next Monday at 1500 hours. That's 3 p.m. And then there is the Saturday edition book reading of the book entitled Freedom Sailors, which I actually began last Saturday, the Saturday show. And the reading comes to you at 11 a.m. Pacific Time here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. Have a good one.